Some of you do. Indeed, some of you do. Yes. You'll know it as soon as I mention. The Facebook killer, now who recognizes this guy? Been all over the news, right? There he is. Am I being fair by saying that this is the face of grace-based parenting? Raise your hand if you want to walk out of here already. No. Did anybody see what his job was? You're close. Worse. A spokesman at Stevens' employer told the Erie Times News in a telephone interview on Tuesday afternoon that employees there learned quickly of Stevens' death in Erie via news reports. It's just been a tragic situation on every front with this story, said Nancy Kortemeyer, a senior director of marketing and public relations at Beechbrook, located in Northeast Ohio. Beechbrook is a behavior health organization serving children, teenagers, and families. According to a statement Beechbrook officials posted on the website, Stevens worked there since 2008. Most recently as a vocational specialist for youth and young adults. Prior to that, Stevens had been a youth mentor. And somebody's going to say, hey, wait a minute, this can happen with anyone. Wait a second, before you say that, there should have been some signs, and I didn't quote it, but they said there was nothing. There was nothing to tell them they might be having a problem here. Okay? Now, how do we get there? How does that happen? You see, here's the problem we constantly run into. Hey, Joel, this can happen with anybody. And you know what the result of that statement is? All your child training, all the work you do, all the effort you put into it, it's still a crapshoot. That's what's behind that statement. Really. Well, let's see tonight. Grace-based parenting. Well, there's a few things we want to talk about tonight. Grace-based parenting versus law-based parenting. Now, the name of the book that we're looking at is by Tim Kimmel, called Grace-Based Parenting. I don't know, if I set two books up in the local Christian bookstore, you know what I'm talking about. The local Christian bookstore, and you actually, where they have books sometimes, you will occasionally see books in a Christian bookstore. So if I set up a little display, a book display, perhaps in between the fog machine and the glow-in-the-dark cross, and I had Grace-Based Parenting book and law-based parenting book, I don't know. Any thoughts on which one sells and which one sits? So tonight, I don't want to blame the author Tim Kimmel so much. I will somewhat. But really, it's his audience. It's the people that want to read it. So let's not forget that. I want you to know tonight that this particular book, written about maybe 10, 12 years ago, endorsed by such notables as Kevin Lehman, author, John and Cindy Trent, authors and speakers and presidents of he's the president of strongfamilies.com, Howard Hendricks of Dallas Theological Seminary, Josh McDowell, Joe Stowell, president of Moody Bible Institute. Joe Stowell, I've heard him speak. I feel he's a respectable guy. One thing you're going to see tonight is that the author actually makes no distinction between grace and law. Now, if you can't make a distinction between grace and law, you probably shouldn't be writing too many books about child training. Why do we need grace? We need grace because law exists in the first place. Do we not? Law exists. You know when Moses came down from the mountain with 10 commandments, like, how about this? Don't worship other gods. Don't bow down to graven images. Don't use the Lord's name in vain. And so on and so forth. That wasn't like new information. Those laws already existed. They were just codified. And that law kills us because we can't keep it. It's grace that gets us into heaven. It's grace that justifies us. When it comes to children, I want to ask you, is it possible to rear children so that they'll actually live without law. How about this law? Don't play in the street. Sound like a law to you? It does to me. I promise you it's going to sound like a law to the children when they hear it. How about this one for a law? Here's a popular law. Don't make me count to three. You're really going to be in trouble if I count to three. Of course, all kids are terrorized when they hear that, right? Oh, no, mom's going to say three, and then what am I going to do? By the way, have you ever heard a mom get to three when she says, don't make me count to three? I saw it just today. Just today I saw it. Mom's counting to three. Right, one, kids ignore. Two, kid totally right. Mom doesn't say three. Of course, she runs over and grabs the little wiggly toddler up and carries him off. One day, the wiggly little toddler is not going to be a little toddler anymore. He's going to be too big to carry off. You might want to think about that. Thirdly, I want to talk about a concept that's kind of lost us here. A little bit of tough love. Let me ask this question. How does tough love fit into grace-based parenting? How do they work together? I was very fortunate, I might have mentioned this before, extremely fortunate when my daughters were growing up. They were all three together. And I was fortunate enough to read them the entire Little House series, the entire thing. I think if they would have been spread out, I don't think I would have been able to get it done, but I was able to do that. There's one book called Farmer Boy, which is not about Laura Ingalls Wilder. It's about the man she eventually married, Armando Wilder. And there's an incident there in the book where he was out there with his father on ice on a river. Now, that's a pretty dangerous place to be. It's dangerous enough to be on ice on a pond or a lake. But on a river, if you go through on a river, they have a hard time getting you back again because the current pulls you. At one point in the book, Almanzo's father is just this close to really lighting him up. And by lighting him up, I don't mean counting to three or making him stand in the corner. I mean lighting him up. Glowing in the dark, lighting him up. And you know what Almanzo had done? He had gone past where his father had said on the river and gotten right beside the hole in the ice. And his father told him, if you ever do that again, I'm going to make sure that you're encouraged not to repeat that action. Now here's a question for you. Was that grace-based parenting right there? You bet it was. You know why? Because when it comes to parenting, grace is always connected with law, but they're not the same thing. You see, the law was don't get near the edge. And the grace in this case is, if you do it again, this is grace. If you do that again, you're going to wish you hadn't. That's grace. Total abandonment. He said, you know, little Monzo, you know how kids are? Yeah, they're always goofing around. Look at him. He's right by the ice. Don't fall, Monzo. Not at all. But my question to you is this. In our modern books, where we talk about rearing children and raising them up in the next generation, we love a title like this because you know what it sounds like? Oh, what happened to my... You know what this kind of sounds like here? It just sort of kind of sounds like we can maybe just be friends with everybody, be friends with our children. Not hardly. Is there any end to the smorgasbord of books, videos, tapes, and seminars that tell us how best to bring up the next generation? In the time that we have, it is my purpose to examine what I believe represents a parenting approach based on grace. However, since this approach is not based on God's law, nor even defines itself as such, it is by definition lawless. Not a good word, lawless. But anything that doesn't embrace the law of God is, by definition, lawless. I see no other, I don't see any other way here to do this. My purpose here is not to skewer the book entitled Grace-Based Parenting by Tim Kimmel. Rather, we wish to establish the following. First, lawless child training is impossible. If you're going to approach the rearing of your children lawlessly, you won't have a child to bring up for very long. Secondly, parents are responsible to go to the Bible first for their instruction. Think of some child training books as you've read and seen. I haven't read as many since, maybe since 15, 20 years ago, in my case. You know, we have entire books that barely mention the Proverbs of talking about your children and what needs to be done corporal punishment-wise. The Bible's clear on that in Proverbs. This particular book doesn't even address that verse. You know, there's a really stiff verse, you know, about chasing your child and delivering a soul from hell. Remember that one? Remember that one? We've got that's quite a comment, is it not? And I believe that the hell there actually may be better translated death. Still, I don't know if you're going to write a child training book. You might want to, interact with that verse a little bit. Parents are responsible to go to the Bible first. Thirdly, then, grace-based parenting is a misnomer in that it makes, as the basis of child training, ability to administer grace rather than responsibility to obey the Bible. How skillful are you at just handing out grace like confetti? You know what? Your first responsibility is find out what the Bible says about what you're supposed to do and go do it. That's your first responsibility. How do you even know how to hand out grace if you know what the Bible says to begin with anyway? How do you know what you're doing is gracious? One more thing. If our responsibility as parents is to obey God, then we must be very concerned about how He feels about our parenting. The present title under discussion presents much about feelings. It is very concerned about feelings, but it is not concerned about God's feelings. And here are some of the main points. Children feel significant when their parents regularly affirm them. Children feel significant when they know they have our attention. Children feel significant when they are gracefully admonished. You see what the basis is here? See what the basis is? It's how the child feels. Now, I could certainly go along with that if we actually had a Bible that taught this. There'll be a question and answer time a little bit later. Maybe in the time I finish, the brain works faster than than talking. You think faster than you can talk. Maybe you can think of some verses that connect with this. You see, again, my purpose is not to skewer the book, because I think the book itself, over a million copies sold, I think a million copy bestseller, I think the book itself just really reflects more the culture and the people that want to buy the book. And I think the book actually is somewhat representative of what passes for what passes for child training these days. Now, how do we get here? Are we really prepared to base our child training on how our children feel? Stop there for a moment. Is that your paradigm? I have a child here, and my whole child training is going to be based on how they feel. How would that look? I want to get back to that. Let's ask a question. If we really are serious about basing our parenting on how our children feel, what would that look like? Let's face it. At a minimum, they would be totally unprepared to function in a world that doesn't care too much how they feel. Come on. Really now. When you go out to work, oh yeah, maybe your boss will come around and ask you how you feel from time to time. Nothing wrong with that. How you doing? Bad news. If you can't do the job, the boss doesn't really care too much how you feel. Because it's the boss's job to go get somebody else who can do the job, and then we'll sort out the feelings. This is a disastrous method, my friends. Yes, we're concerned about how our children feel. Yes, we are. But how are we going to prepare them if all we care about is how they feel? The real test of a parenting model is how well equipped the children are to move into adulthood as members of the human race. This is from Grace-Based Parenting. Okay? Read that again. The real test of a parenting model is how well equipped the children are to move into adulthood as vital members of the human race. Two problems here. Well, there's a lot of problems, but two I'm going to actually three I'll point out. How can you possibly prepare your child as a vital member of the human race if the entirety of your child training is based on the children's feelings? Secondly, can we mention something here about God, the Bible, the kingdom of heaven, the future of Christendom here? Nothing. Nothing. Now, I'm going to ask you something. We've got a Christian book here. Could this real test, okay? We're down to brass tacks right here. Could this comment be written in pretty much any child training book you've heard of, whether Christian or secular? Would any secular writer have a problem with this comment? Not hardly. And this is our real test in a Christian book? Let me ask this question. What does it even mean to be a vital member of the human race? Okay. In North America, it means what? Two cars, garage, fence, good job, don't bug the neighbors, don't get too many speeding tickets, not too many DUIs in a row so you lose your license, go to the ball game every once in a while, hang out, don't bother other people too much. But what a vital member of the human race, what does a vital member of the human race mean in Iran? What's it mean in India? Sri Lanka? How about the Congo? See, if our definitions aren't even coming from the Bible, where are we? A vital members of the human race, that could mean just about anything depending on the culture that you're from. And this is our test, our real test of a parenting model. Are we beginning to see why we're in such a mess here? Based on a child's feelings, nothing about God, the Bible, the kingdom of heaven, a vital member of the human race. We don't know. I sure don't know. Maybe someone can explain it to me a little bit later. Another word, speaking of fears, if your child attends the public school system, a grace-based family makes it easier for him or her to succeed because you are not intimidated by the inherent shortcomings inside the public school system. If you aren't afraid of what's out there, it's a lot easier for your child to thrive spiritually inside the antagonistic environment they might find at school. Now, there's a lot here, but let's just address something here. You know, you all know me. When it comes to public education, I'm a hater. But here's the thing that we have to know. For example, in Uganda, this is just one example, Uganda is trying to turn itself into a Christian nation. South Sudan is trying to do the same thing. And in public schools there, they study the Bible in some cases. You see, what we really have to be concerned about is all education, whether it's a homeschool, whether it's a private Christian school. There's some crazy stuff going on in some of these schools. No matter where it's from, if it's godless, it's no good, and it will destroy your child, if your child believes it, if you're not able to deprogram that child. But see, what concerns me about here is this idea of being intimidated by the inherent shortcomings. What does that really mean? You're intimidated. What, you're scared? You know, it's kind of funny. It looks like we've got some fear going on, right? And we know the Bible says the fear of the Lord is beginning of wisdom, fear of the Lord is beginning of knowledge. And I guess he might be saying that if you really fear God, you won't fear what's going on in the school. But if you fear God, you might be concerned about what's being taught to your children. Maybe. Again, how did we get here? Can anyone doubt the present state of the family is, well, putting it charitably, not too good? But I believe that grace-based parenting is more a symptom than a cause. Through logical and theological failure, the following concepts have been misunderstood and therefore misapplied. First of all, grace. All right, we're going to stretch out here a little bit now and say some things that you're going to be like, "Oh, Joel, where'd you get this one?" But here's the thing. We are told things like love God, love your neighbor, right? We are told to love. Where are we told to be gracious? In other words, here's what I'm saying. I want you to think about this. I don't see in the Bible where we are a source of grace in the same sense that we're supposed to be a source of love because God has loved us. We have verses like God, we love him because he first loved us. Do we have a lot of statements in the Bible, be gracious to other people because God's been gracious to you? Now, maybe you can think of some, and we can talk about that later, but I don't see this idea of this source of grace in the Bible as what we're talking about here. Yes, we love our children, but how do we love our children? We love our children first by loving God and obeying him, right? That's our first task here. Secondly, a misapplication of the word of law. What am I talking about here? Well, in our modern Christian culture, what do we do with this? What do we do with this little L word right here? I submit to you that in most of our Christian culture, it's one of the most scary words ever. We just don't like that word. I've heard sermons preaching through Psalm 119. Have you ever heard this? I have, right? Oh, how I love your law, right? And he'll read it out of Psalm 119, right? And he'll read law, right? But by the time he explains it, it's not law anymore. Have you ever seen that? I've seen it plenty of times. It comes out word. We just hate that L word. Just don't like it. Open now mine eyes, Psalm 119:9, that I may behold wondrous things from your law. Oh, that just becomes word. You see, if we misunderstand the one, we're going to misunderstand. They come as a package. Thirdly, creator-creature distinction. We must always remember that we will never be God. Never, ever will we be God. Ever. If God is the one that first gives grace and first loves, we love him because he first loved us. Well, then, we must understand that our method of dealing with other people and dealing with God must come from him, as long as we understand that we're not God. But if our parenting is going to depend on us and it's formulaic and this is what you got to do here and there and so forth, we're going to get ourselves mixed up with God after a while. But you know what will happen when our kids turn out poorly? Guess who gets the blame? Not us. God gets the blame. Fourthly, the nature of discipline. Let's take a little bit of time to talk about this here. We've talked about this briefly but in the past. But let's talk about it. Nature of discipline. Let's talk about the nature of discipline versus the nature of punishment. Question for you, is all punishment discipline? No way. Now, you've seen it already in the grocery store, haven't you? The punishment comes out, the hand comes out, or the yelling comes out, and the demeaning statements to the child come out. You've heard it. There's punishment going on, but not discipline. What's really discipline when you're talking about your child? Well, when your child responds to your word You have a disciplined child, do you not, on your hands? When the responsible, but when they're constantly responding to flee, you pick them up, they're running off, and you pick them up, and then you put them down, they run off. Pretty soon, you can't pick them up anymore. Then the words start going back and forth at each other. And you start the punishment by put-downs and slams. And after a while, it comes back at you. You see, discipline is occurs. And sometimes the punishment can be really, really light. But discipline occurs when a child says to himself, you know, if I had the opportunity to do that again, I wouldn't do it. And a child is standing there thinking, a disciplined child is basically acting in his best self-interest. And he's saying to himself, you know, it's in my best interest not to disobey the word I just got from my mother. It's in my best interest. Because if I do this, I'm sure to be sorry about it. At that point, discipline has happened. And there's a lot of different ways to discipline. But punishment always often takes the place of discipline, right? Where we just had it and had it and had it and had it with that kid. And then the hand comes out and slaps the face. Or comes down on the shoulder. Or there's a word spoken, I hate you. That word will come back later on from that child. You can be sure. I hate you language. Now, my friends, disciplining our children disciplines us. It's hard work. I think it was a lot harder work. Dealing with the drugs and the unwed pregnancies and the door slams. You'll really work then. See, the nature of child discipline is necessary there because without it, all you have left is a child left to himself. And what does the Bible say about a child left to himself? Brings ruin. Ruin! It's a big word. Finally, then, the purpose of child training. What am I talking about, the purpose of child training? What is the purpose of child training, then? Okay, we disagreed with Kimball's model earlier. What is the purpose? Child that, you know, good neighbor, goes to church with the kids for a while. Let's think about this here, my friends. Lest you think I'm being too hard, we know that the statistics say that 7 to 8 out of 10 children will leave the faith. Some will come back. Many will never come back. So if you think I'm being too hard, how did we get there? How did we get to that point? What kind of books have we been reading this whole time? Well, I would urge all parents and prospective parents to get a good understanding of the above, otherwise they stay out of the parenting business. What's the key? Understand the relationship of all these five. And the purpose of child training, right here, purpose of child training is to raise up a young man or a young woman who loves the Lord his God with all his heart and his neighbor as himself. That's what we're aiming at, my friends. And it may or may not have a house with a picket fence. It may be wind up in a jungle someplace. But that's our purpose. And is everything we do with our children, with this goal in mind, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and your neighbors yourself. Why shouldn't that be the purpose of our child training? Jesus Christ said in Luke 10 that that's the purpose of the entire law. First 39 books summed up. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and your neighbor as yourself. That's the parenting model that we must embrace, that the author of this book apparently completely misses. Let's point out something else, though. This is critical. I ask a question that you think about for a minute, then we'll answer it. When we read about child training in the Bible, and the Bible has much to say about it, is it mostly directed at parents, or is it mostly directed at children? There are passages directed at parents. There definitely are. Fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath, but bring them back up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. That's definitely addressed to parents. But I submit to you tonight that we're really missing it. We're missing a lot, I should say, with all of our child training books aimed at parents. Because by far, my friends, the vast majority of child training verses in the Bible are aimed at children. You know what they are. Starts out the Ten Commandments, right? Honor your father and your mother. Who's that aimed at? Aimed at children, right? How about Ephesians 6:1? Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Who's that aimed at? Clearly children. How about Colossians 3:20? Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. I was looking at Proverbs here as I was getting ready for this. Do you know what that divides the first, eight chapters in Proverbs? You know, it starts out with a kind of like an introduction to the Proverbs of Solomon. And his purpose, to know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity. And he's got his purposes there. Give prudence to the simple, to the young man, knowledge and discretion. And so he does that for seven verses. And then he starts out in verse 8 with, my son, instruction to his child from his father. You see, you could say that this is instruction to the father, but it's ultimately instruction to the father to be able to properly instruct his son. Chapter 2, my son, if you receive my words, starts out that way. Chapter 3 starts out, my son, do not forget my law. Wait a second. Hold on. My son, do not forget my law, but let your heart keep my commandments. Honestly, can a verse like that go into most child training books being written today from the Christian circles? Go on. Chapter 4. Hear, my children, the instruction of a father, and give attention to no understanding. Chapter 5. My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Chapter 6. My son, if you become surety for your friend, talk about lending money. Chapter 7. My son, keep my words. Chapter 8, it switches gears a little bit. Now, the Bible does definitely speak to both. Let's be really clear on that. But where's the books directed to children about their responsibility? I want to tell you something. This entire book, I saw very, very little about the child's responsibility. It's all in the parents. You got to think about that. One of the things it talks about is beef night. And that's not a night where we sit around the table and eat beef. That's not what it's talking about. Beef night occurs when we call the family together and the kids all talk about about the failures of the parents. And in order to properly administer beef night, the parents don't explain or they don't have a conversation. But the parents are allowed to apologize for their terrible parenting. That's beef night in grace-based parenting. One of the things he says, and I didn't even want to put it up here. One of the things he says is, you know, we need to give our kids a break. It's not the end of the world if they watch The Simpsons. Okay, I agree. Fan of The Simpsons here. Homer Simpson is actually one of the best fathers on television. You know that, right? Most television fathers are complete buffoons compared to Homer Simpson, and he's not so bright himself. But he's, up until recently, the writers have kept him faithful to his wife and kind of there for his kids in a kind of a dysfunctional sort of a way. And then he goes on to say, watching The Simpsons, listening to rock music. Okay. Then he goes on to say, don't even want to say the word, a certain type of extremely intimate kissing. Okay? He's saying, why give your heart kids a hard time for that? He definitely doesn't distinguish that this is done in marriage. No, he gives a green light for kids to do that stuff. I'm like, whoa. You mean it's okay for my son to do that to your daughter there, Tim? You're okay with that? Apparently, you're a bad parent if you have a problem with it. You can read that in the book. You can get the Kindle version and just do a little word search for kissing, and you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. But there's something underlying this whole thing as we wrap up. Please understand this. And this is the condemnation, that light has come into the world and men love darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. One of the things that he says early in the book that I think it gives the direction of the entire book, but also is an indictment against our Christian culture. He says something that almost everybody can agree with. And I want you to hear what I'm saying here. He says that, you know, one of the purposes of parenting our children is to act like a porch light. Those that don't know Christ, those who are seeking for Christ will see our porch light. And they'll come on and they'll believe us and want to become Christians. That, my friend, that type of teaching and thinking is all throughout Christianity today. Is it true and is it right? Well, it's definitely not according to this. Look what John has to say about the light. You turn the light on and the rats and the roaches can't find the corners fast enough. Their job is to shut that light down. Now, we also have Matthew, let your light so shine, so that men may see it and glorify your Father which is in heaven. That's true. And that's going to happen to the redeemed, those who believe. But those who don't believe are going to be unhappy with the light. We heard from Matthew Henry talking about that. If you were in IRBC last Sunday or two Sundays ago. Talking about envy. Talking about people who produce. Talking about people who make life better for their neighbors and they get wealthy. And what happens? There's other people that envy them and put them down just because they're working hard and they're achieving things. And Matthew Henry went on to say, oftentimes, the more good you do, the more people hate you. Now, why am I saying this? Well, you know what? Understand this. If you obey God and raise your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, you will have people that hate your guts. And I don't see that in too many child training books. But that's very consistent with this right here. Not everybody will. Those that love Christ will want to learn and will want to know. But there are those that hate Christ, and guess what? They're going to hate you because they see Christ in you. Just what this is saying. Finally, I ask the question. What does grace-based parenting look all about? And that's how he's defining it. Grace-based parenting, all about a child's feelings. What's that look like? Well, one of the things it's going to look like is, as John Bingaman pointed out when we talked about this the other night, how about safe spaces in college campuses? Are you kidding me? You've been in school for 13 years, and you go to college for a safe space? Have we lost our mind? I don't even know how to interact with that. I'm going to go to a safe space, you know, where everybody just says nice self-affirming things about me, tells me what a wonderful person I am. My friends, we will lose our ability to think. If we can't handle an opinion or a comment that we don't like, We will, after a while, not be able to think. You know why? Because after a while, we'll be thinking only about ourselves, and we know that the way of a man to understand is not in yourself. You have to look outside. You have to look to God. And if you become your own God, you will not be able to use your brain. We already know this was happening half the colleges, but I want to wrap up here with something else. Y'all see this, right? This would be a bike helmet, right? How many of you would be like really challenged to figure out what this is for, what it's supposed to do? Well, you don't have to be too challenged because I have some directions. I have some input for you. Now, if you bought this helmet, you would get these directions and you'd be helped out by this. And there's some that, you know, your new helmet provides protection while you're riding your bicycle on or off the road. Glad I got the directions for that information. To ensure proper use of this helmet, take the time to familiarize with the helmet's features, fit, and care. All right. Intended use. Helmet is designed to provide limited added protection to the head. I didn't get that myself. I'm going to go over that again. Helmet is designed to provide limited added protection to the head, but cannot guard against all types of impacts causing injury to head. Okay, I got that. Neck, spine, or other areas of the body. I am so glad I got these directions. I thought that if I wore a helmet, it just protected every square inch of my body. But I've gotten some more insight here. Here we go. This helmet is not for use by persons who cannot comfortably support the helmet's weight. Yeah, you put a strap on your kid, his head falls over like this. Get out the directions. It gets better. Children under the age of one should be evaluated by a pediatrician to verify adequate neck musculature before using any helmet. Okay. Fit and protection. This helmet can only protect it if it fits well. The buyer should try different sizes and choose the size which feels secure and comfortable on the head. Now the problem is, I can only read this after I buy the stinking helmet. Man, I wish I would have known that before I bought the helmet. What were they thinking? Too late. This helmet provides no protection to parts of the body that it does not cover directly. Here's one that I just I'm so glad it's in here. Fasten all retention straps securely. The buckle should be positioned away from the jawbone. The straps and buckles should be adjusted to be both comfortable and firm. It cannot be, if proper fit cannot be achieved, obtain a helmet that fits correctly before using. Now, am I being too hard? This is not atypical, my friends. Have you seen those goofy labels on like mattresses and stuff? Do not remove, but there's a penalty of law, or under penalty of law, a bug spray. And there's a federal warning on the bug spray that you have to use it according to its intended use, or you've committed a federal offense. And this is just the surface, my friends. This is the result of what we're going to call grace-based parenting, what I'm calling it, the way the world defines it. You know, this entire directions here, I think it's all about trying to make me feel good about my new helmet. I think that's what it really is. Well, I'm going to switch gears here a little bit. What does parenting look like? I have a favorite Christmas carol. It's a Christmas carol that doesn't mention Christmas at all. Anybody ever hear of Good King Wenceslas? You know, that song, I think, demonstrates parenting. It demonstrates it's not a father and a son, it's a king and a page. Okay? But let's think about these words and think about our jobs, especially as dads and moms, about what we're really trying to do. What we're really trying to do is raise a child who is very good at loving God and loving his neighbor. And you know, that's why we go through hard things, because sometimes it's a hard thing to love your neighbor. Sometimes you have to work really hard. Sometimes you have to go through pain. Come on. If loving your neighbor was that easy, everybody'd want to do it, right? Good King Wenceslas looked out on the Feast of Stephen, when the snow lay round about deep and crisp and even. Brightly shone the moon that night, though the frost was cruel, when a poor man came in sight, gathering winter fuel. Hither, page, this is King Wenceslas talking, and by the way, I'll stop here for a second. There's two King Wenceslas. One was good and one was bad, so don't get the good one mixed up with the bad one if you study this king. He's a very good king, was killed at a young age by a family member. Hither, page, and stand by me, if thou knowest the telling. Yonder peasant, who is he? Where and what is dwelling? Sire, he lives a good league hence, underneath the mountain, right against the forest fence, by St. Agnes Fountain. Bring me flesh and bring me wine, bring me pine logs hither. Thou and I will see him dine when we bear them thither. Page and monarch, forth they went together, through the rude wind's wild lament and the bitter weather. This is the page talking. Sire, the night is darker now, and the wind blows stronger. Fails my heart, I know not how, I can go no longer. Mark my footsteps, good my page, tread thou in them boldly. Thou shalt find the winter's rage, freeze thy blood less coldly. In his master's steps he trod, where the snow lay dinted. Heat was in the very sod where the saint had printed. Therefore, Christian men, be sure, wealth or rank possessing, ye who now will bless the poor shall yourselves find blessing. You see the teaching that was going on there? The courage that was being handed down to that page from that king. Parenting is a big, wonderful job. It's done by parents who love God and love their neighbor. And anything less than what we see with this good king here, and I don't know if it's apocryphal or exactly what it is, but oftentimes these stories grow up based on some things that happen and the character of the king for sure. Here's a king that does it himself. Of course, our modern politicians would say, look, there's a poor guy. Let's go tax the populace and give him something. In this case, the king goes out himself, and he doesn't go by himself. He teaches his page what to do. It's a big job, my friends. It's based on God's law. It's based on what the Bible says. And it's not based on the child's feelings. You see, here we have it. Sire, the wind is darker now, or the night is darker now, and the wind blows stronger. Fails my heart, I know not how. I can go no longer. Let's see, if we're all about the page's feelings right now, what happens next? Get cold. You'll feel warmer if you go inside. Let's go inside. One thing else I like about this, too, this is not the night for this, but here in the beginning, when a poor man came in sight, gathering winter fuel, the king went and helped him. He was already doing what he could do. Okay, this is not the night to talk about social programs and welfare and all that stuff. We're not going to do it. But in this tune, in this poem, he's already working. He's not sitting at home waiting for somebody else to do it for him. And that's how the king notices him, because he was already at work. I didn't talk about Dr. Spock's, Dr. Benjamin Spock, you know, baby and child care. I didn't talk about him. He was a godless man who wanted to tell us all about baby and child care, written in 1946, as I found out the other night. Died in 1990. You know what he said towards the end of his life? And he was all about permissive parenting. He was all about Sigmund Freud. His number one rule of child training was, now I've forgotten it. It was, I'll read it to you. Trust your instincts. Number one, routines are nice. Number two, but babies don't need a strict regimen. Okay. Number three, don't fret if your baby acts funny. Freud can explain it. Number three rule. Number four, ideas about good parenting should evolve. Now, if your ideas about good parenting are evolving, how do you even know they're any good? How would you know that? Oh, I know how you know. Because we don't have a Bible anymore. We don't have a standard. The standard is me, and whatever I do is good. Spock continues to update baby and child care throughout his life. It's a little bit interesting. Updating your book about baby and child care. Okay, maybe. Reminds me a little bit of an updated prophecy chart. But, I mean, I don't think we can blame him for updating it, really. I guess not. His first edition, after all, was published in 1946 when parenting, at least for infants, meant almost exclusively mothering. Over the decades, Spock came to view this as wrong. He embraced an increased role for the fathers and adopted a more gender-neutral tone, expunging sexual stereotypes from the book. By the 1990s, and this is a mega bestseller, many Christians purchased this book and went by it. By the 1990s, he was taking on the fight against childhood obesity and wanted to include information for gay and lesbian parents. Crucially, he also changed the way he dealt with his own family. And listen to this. Shortly before Spock's death, journalist and writer Thomas Mayer published a biography of the man, Dr. Spock, An American Life. In it, Meyer writes this, Spock acknowledged being too career-driven and in recent years made a concerted effort to show more affection to his grown sons in a way they said had never happened in their youth. He recognized the inconsistencies between his public and private lives, the insurmountable gap he had trouble reconciling even in his own mind. His lesson to fathers, Spock now told the interviewer, comes through my writing, not my example. And his fifth comment, babies need love. Well, you know, I'm kind of happy to know that. Well, we took on a lot tonight. Who has a question? I didn't even say half the stuff I wanted to.
Maybe more just a comment. You started with the example of Almanzo's father telling him that he would be disciplined severely if he ever did that again. But the reason that works is because he had previously been disciplined for things. Like you.
Yeah, that was not the first time.
Right. Yeah. The threat of a discipline only works if they know that there's actually a follow-through at some point, right? I mean, if I only ever say to my kid, I'm going to get you, but you never actually get them, then it doesn't mean anything.
They don't even know what right? that means.
Yeah.
They don't know.
Right. So
what do you mean you're going to get me?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I that 1-2-3 thing is just annoying. It just is. I saw that at a Christian... this summer, I was at a Christian Bible conference campground, and there was a child on the swing. Child was at least 5 or 6, no infant, no toddler. And same thing, it was time to go, gets louder, time to go, say a name, 1, 2, Never did say three. Just went over, grab the kid, drag him off. That's not training. You haven't done any training. Yes.
I don't have my Bible, but I think is it Hebrews 11 or 12 when the Bible talks about that when we discipline our children, we're loving them, or we're showing them love.
Hebrews definitely says that, and I believe it's Hebrews 12.
And I've had some counsel that has said that our children feel loved. Children do feel loved when they're disciplined. And what would be, would you comment, could you comment on that?
They feel loved when they're disciplined?
So not exactly when they're being disciplined.
Okay.
But children who are disciplined know that their parents love them because their parents discipline them.
Yeah.
They might not show it right there at that particular time. Would you agree with that, you know, from the Bible, or would?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I will say, though, that when I got lit up from time to time as a kid, it really didn't feel like love to me at that time. It felt horrible. I didn't like it. I didn't have grace-based parenting, I suppose. But what really worked for me was that combination of, yes, discipline like that. This is unacceptable behavior. You can't do this, Joel. You're not going to do this. Combined with the example that I had from my mother and father, who did themselves not violate what they're telling me not to do, I don't think there's anything stronger than that. A good example and love that shows itself in a proper love to God and love one's neighbor, because your first neighbor is clearly your children. Clearly. Here's something that should make it into a lot more child training books. Listen to this from Genesis 18. Things aren't going too good for Sodom and Gomorrah. And God comes down to visit Abraham, I think as the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Some people disagree with me on that, but that's really not our point tonight. And God says this in verse 17. Sodom and Gomorrah are about to get the ultimate punishment. Sodom and Gomorrah have not lived under any restraints up to this point, apparently. Everybody's just doing what they want to do. Is this our idea of grace-based parenting? I hope not. Or maybe it is. Or certainly shouldn't be our idea of proper parenting. But see, that's the problem. That's why we set up barriers for our children. That's why we punish for certain things. Because if we don't punish, guess what? They're going to get out there, they're going to get punished. They get punished eventually. This shouldn't be hard. Listen to what God says. And the Lord said, let's start in the previous verse. Then the men arose from there and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham stood with them to send them on their way. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? And I think he's asked the question like, what am I supposed to do? I think he's answering with a no. Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have known him. This is. Listen to this. For I have known him in order that he may command his children. Do you know there's ideas going on around out there now that you should never say no to your children? Shouldn't command them ever. That's flying around out there. How soon is it going to be right in our own Christian circles under a Christian book name? This is God speaking about Abraham. For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. Talk about a description of loving God and loving one's neighbor. He is going to be a blessing to all the nations because they're going to learn righteousness and justice from him. And you know how it's starting? It's starting with a quite quite an example of serious discipline on Sodom and Gomorrah. That's the context in which we find it. Yes.
Yeah, that whole breakdown there is teaching authority to the younger. He was teaching Abraham, you better discipline your people, because if you don't, this is what's going to
happen. This is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You're going to get Sodom and Gomorrah.
There's a breakdown in authority when the child is not disciplined correctly. He doesn't understand authority. He doesn't even get to love. He doesn't understand authority. Consequently, he cannot understand love.
This is true. Yes.
Whom the Lord loves, he chastens.
That's from Hebrews 12. Well, that's from Proverbs. I'm not sure if Hebrews repeats that or not, but it may. Hebrews may repeat that.
But in this book...
Actually, I think it is.
And you didn't bring it out tonight, but you did last week when we talked about this, that the author says that we should parent as God parents us. I think it's important to note that we are representing God to our children, and we are to parent as God parents us, but not necessarily by grace only, not only by showing them permissiveness, but showing them the discipline. Children desperately want to know what their boundaries are, and they press until they find them. But who's going to show them if it's not their parents? Just a comment.
Who indeed? Yeah, one of the things that concerns me about this, I didn't really talk about it, but I'm very worried about the amount of environmentalism being taught here. And here's what I mean here. That your child, it's all about your child's environment. You know, the Bible really doesn't say that much about the child's environment. It just doesn't. It says a lot more about the responsibility of parents and children, and very little about your environment. Concerns me. Yes.
I have a question. We have friends who are, they don't have the example of good discipline in both their homes. The mom is from a single, her mom was a widow, and did a single parent thing from another culture, and the husband was raised in a Catholic kind of free-for-all. There were beatings, but, you know, not really consistent. Zillion siblings, yeah. Every stereotype.
Beatings that are about the parent feeling better because they've had enough.
Sure.
Not about child training.
Sure.
And I've had enough, you want to beat the daylights out of you.
Right.
Terrible.
Who knows?
It's terrible.
And their first child is now two, and they just had a second one, and they just don't know where, like, they get it, like, yeah, we should, at some point, kids should be spanked. They just don't know when to start that, like, when to, like, do you want to spank a six-month-old? And then it gets too late, and then you feel cruel because now there's these new rules. And we don't know how, like, how can we direct this whole generation who are trying to start from scratch, who didn't have the example of situationally, in this situation, how do I handle this right this second?
All righty. Now, unless I miss my guess, every single person in this room now has an opinion on that one. And I'm the guy with the mic. Everybody's going to have an opinion on that one. I can just tell you very quickly how I've counseled people in the short end of it. First of all, this is very difficult when you've never had the example. It's tough. But there are times when a child will test his parents. When you very specifically say, no, don't touch that, or no, don't do that, and you know they understand the difference. Six-month-old, do they even understand language? And yeah, I would argue you better watch yourself and do not spank a child unless you know that they are clearly disobeying your word. And here's the thing. Every parent will have that in the life of a child, or maybe almost every parent, maybe not all. But a child will eventually test you. Do you mean what you say? And in that moment, the child has to be convinced that you do mean what you say. And that's the moment the child is giving you a wonderful opportunity. It's your opportunity now to let that child know that you mean what you say. And if the child disobeys you, you will now convince the child that it would have been in his best interest to do what he was told. What I see happening in a lot of homes is this. Parents miss those opportunities a lot. You get the opportunity. The kid's going to do it. And you better step up when that happens. Because if you don't step up then those are the parents often go, I just don't know. Well, this child is driving me crazy. Won't do what I say. I just don't know. We got to go to counseling. Wait a minute. Take the easy ones. Take the low-hanging fruit. And the other ones will work out themselves. But I've seen it again and again. They don't take the low hand. They don't do it when the child disobeys. I saw this at a homeschool convention. It was a play at a homeschool. You know where all the homeschoolers are all. We're all good, right? We all have this down, right? Yeah, we do. This kid got up, and she started just kind of showing off, right? And I saw the mom. I was watching. Saw the mom say, "Stop that," right? No effect whatsoever. Kid kept doing it. Mom says again, "Stop that." Kept doing it. Kid got a little bored with everything. And mom said, "Well, come here." Kid didn't. What do you think happens next? Well, you know the story, so I'll tell you, of course. The kid just trotted off after the mom said, "Come here." Kid just trotted off. La, la, la. You know what the mom did? It was while the play was going. You know what the mom did? We were sitting on the gym floor is where we were. You know what the mom does? Goes back to watching the play. You know, that mom is going to say later, "Oh, that's Charlie. I tried to do the right thing. You know, I brought him to church, homeschooled." You failed miserably at the very opportunity that child gave you. But you see, to Annie's point later, that wasn't the first time. That was 100th time. And I counsel parents, your child will give you that opportunity. Look for it and don't blow it. Because the more you blow that opportunity, the more that child's going to test you. And the more times you'll have to convince that child. I was going to say something else, but it'd be definitely self-serving. And I shouldn't do that. I can't do it anyway. So, yeah. You know, some of the stuff is hard, too. I'll just share this. Most of you know Charles Van Veek, who was here. He spoke. And he actually said to me, he said, "I want you to come down." And this is to the point of how to even begin sometimes. How do you even begin? Our culture is so fragmented. How do you start? And he gave me a situation. I don't know how I'd start. Maybe somebody here has a really good opinion. Sid, you and I talked about this. He said, "Joel, why don't you come down?" He says, "We're doing camps for kids in the Congo. They love the camps, but the adults want something for them." He says, "Really like you to come to Africa and teach parents, teach family for a week." So we're talking about this a little bit. He said, "Now you have to understand something here, Joel. You're going to be talking to men who beat their wives. It's what they do. They beat their wives." And so Audrey was there too, and he also said, "Hey, maybe you could teach the women." And so we're both scratching our heads, and we're thinking, how do you teach a woman whose husband beats her respect? And how do you teach a man who, it's what he does, and these are professing believers that just haven't been taught much of anything. And they beat their wives. It's what they do. Their dad beat their mom. They beat their wives. And you know what? I don't have an answer. I truly don't have a good answer of what I would tell a bunch of guys who've only known beating their wives, and that's how they do. There's got to be a way. This stuff is hard. You see, when the family breaks down, it's hard to put it back together again. That's why we have to work so hard on this kinds of things, because you know what? Most families that we know out there have big, big problems. Big problems. Most families. I'm going to tell you, when I was a kid, I didn't know most families, but it was a rare thing when I was a kid to have, the divorce was rare. It was rare. And some people say, well, they just lived with each other, even though they hated each other. Well, I got into a lot of homes. I went to school, and I got a lot of my friends' homes, and it didn't seem like their parents hated each other to me. And you know how sensitive kids are about those kinds of things. Kids can figure that stuff out. Now, things are different. I get angry when I think about the 60s and all the free love. Was that grace-based parenting going on back then? Oh, go ahead, move in, sleep around, whatever. You're an adult. Where's the law? The Bible has things to say about this kind of stuff. But we thought we could safely ignore it, I suppose. Nothing safe about what's going on now, is there? Who else has a question? Difficult topic. Thanks for your attention.